Welcome to episode 4 of the N3SP podcast, a production of the National Security Strategic Studies Partnership, or N3SP. Our guest today is Dr. Tyler Bowen. For the past year, he has served as the Stanton Visiting Scientist at the Air Force Academy's Department of Political Science and as a Scowcroft Fellow with the Academy's Institute of National Security Studies. Tyler earned his PhD at Yale University and served as a postdoctoral fellow at Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, often referred to as SAIS. His research is focused on a variety of issues related to nuclear weapons, strategy, and policy. As with all episodes, the opinions and ideas of the speakers do not necessarily reflect the positions of any government organization, academic institution, or commercial entity and should not be construed to do so. So with that as an introduction, welcome, Tyler. So let's begin by saying a few words about how you got interested in the topic of nuclear weapons.
Well, yeah, first off, thanks for having me. And I did my undergraduate studies at the University of Notre Dame and majored in political science. And while I was doing that, I obviously very fascinated with the international relations subfield and specialized in that. And I took a course on nuclear deterrence and nuclear politics in general. And I, obviously I was very drawn to the topic, but when I went to graduate school, when I started my graduate studies, I didn't think that was going to be my main thing. I thought I would study international relations theory, things like realism and liberalism, and try to make contributions to our understanding of those theories. What I realized is doing my coursework, over the first 2 years of graduate school, it can be a bit of a slog and you're trying to figure out exactly what you want to do for your dissertation. I realized I thought I liked the study of nuclear strategy and policy more. And moreover, I thought that they had nuclear weapons had some big effects on international politics that, at least at the time, I thought went underappreciated. And so that's how I turned my focus to studying nuclear weapons and nuclear strategy and haven't looked back.
Well, very interesting. So let's talk about some of those areas you see nuclear weapons being underappreciated in. So what's kind of changed? Because certainly up until the end of the Cold War, and if we just want to draw a line in the history of the 20th century, call it 1989, because up to that point, we were still negotiating in NATO over the importance of short-range nuclear weapons and things like that. And then everything changed, because the phrase was, well, what do you need these weapons for, to bomb Lech Walesa?
Yeah.
We had allies and soon NATO members in Eastern Europe. But now things are different, and nuclear weapons are back on the agenda. So what do you say in terms of international relations theory or whatever framework you want to use? What's moved the needle on that? What's changed?
Well, I think two things that you're right, that I think nuclear weapons kind of dropped off the map, I think, but the effects they had never went away. And I don't think great power competition ever went away. And I think two things then have really caused all these debates about nuclear weapons that we had in the Cold War to come back. The first is that obviously China is now building a robust second strike nuclear arsenal that can compete with and be roughly this tries to be roughly the size of the United States states' arsenal. Obviously they're building new generations of ICBMs or intercontinental ballistic missiles, as well as submarine launched ballistic missiles, as well as new submarines for those missiles to go on. So they are rapidly modernizing their arsenal, but they're also expanding it, with the Pentagon saying that they would have, I think, 1,000 nuclear warheads or nuclear weapons by 2030.
2030, yes.
And then 1,500, I believe, by 2035 or maybe 2040. I forget the exact year on that. But that's, very close to the size of at least the deployed U.S. arsenal of, I believe, about 1,550 nuclear warheads.
Well, you used a term of art there that I'm familiar with from the Cold War era, but perhaps some listeners aren't. Would you elaborate on the concept of what a second strike nuclear arsenal represents.
Sure.
In terms of strategy.
Yeah. So the idea here is that if you can't just, you know, possessing nuclear weapons in itself is obviously a big deal and has a lot of deterrent power. But the idea is that, you know, if you possess, say, 5 to 10, like a handful of nuclear weapons that could be destroyed by another state, then that doesn't get you, it doesn't get you quite as much deterrent power as saying, I have 100 nuclear weapons and you'll only be able to destroy 50 of them. So if I know that I'll be able, so even if you strike me first with nuclear weapons, destroy half of my arsenal, that's a lot, but even if I am able to strike back with, say, 50 or 100 nuclear weapons, that's enough to inflict devastating punishment on you. So when you have a second strike nuclear arsenal, what you're saying is there's no way to escape the punishment that my nuclear weapons can inflict upon you.
So the survivability of that second strike is either by the sheer numbers,
yep,
providing, hopefully, for the defending country, too many targets to take out,
yep,
leaving a residual that can inflict unacceptable damage, or diversifying those over different methods of delivery. You mentioned submarine-launched ballistic missiles. Air-launched, maybe a little less common these days given the,
yep,
strength of most air defenses, but you diversify the
yeah,
systems.
Yeah, so you either just create lots of nuclear weapons, build lots and lots of nuclear weapons, and or you try to build several different types of nuclear weapons. Maybe they're hardened. Maybe you try to make them mobile somehow with, say, you can put intercontinental ballistic missiles on mobile platforms and move them around the country. You try to just be very good at hiding them somehow in some way.
Which is increasingly difficult these
days.
Which
is increasingly difficult. So I think one of the things that we're realizing now about nuclear deterrence is that each one of those things is becoming harder to conceal your weapons, and even harder because weapons now are so accurate to really use hardening in any real way unless you bury it very deep underground, in which case that makes it a little bit less usable as a weapon. In any case, I think China is doing all of the things, though, to make their arsenal survivable, much more survivable, both by expanding it and by modernizing its forces. And then the second thing is that Russia is just Russia's belligerence, and specifically that they're trying to use their nuclear weapons as a shield to prevent them from, you know, getting any to lessen the amount of pushback that they would get from the U.S. or NATO countries for the aggression against Ukraine and other neighbors.
I seem to remember, I think it was a Chinese general officer, it might have even been an Indian general officer, that made the statement after Operation Desert Storm back in 1991, that one of the takeaway lessons there was that if you don't want to be attacked by a superpower, you need to have nuclear weapons. So you're sort of saying that Russia's trying to exploit its superpower, nuclear-capable status, to avoid at least direct conflict with the United States or other Western powers? Is that the implication?
Yes, I think that's the implication, because I think that if Russia, imagine a world in which Russia and the U.S. did not have nuclear weapons, it's very likely that there could be a direct conflict between the U.S. and Russia right now over Ukraine. But because Russia does have nuclear weapons, the U.S. is obviously very reticent to directly intervene in Ukraine, and thus you have this indirect intervention, effectively trying to make this into a proxy war between the U.S. and Russia, with Ukrainian forces as the proxies, as the agents of the United States and the West in this case.
Now, one of the deals made at the end of the breakup of the Soviet Union, of course, is this agreement, that led to the Ukrainians giving up their nuclear, I won't say their nuclear arsenal, they had nuclear weapons on their soil that were the inheritance of the breakup of the Soviet Union, and by agreement they turned those over to Russia, and that of course left them with none. Whether they could have actually made use of those weapons, we're not getting into technical issues here, but as a status issue, what do you think the lessons now are being drawn for countries that might identify with the plight of Ukraine and rationalize their way to acquiring nuclear weapons because of what they've seen happen?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the effect of U.S. interventions in Iraq, but also Libya as well.
Shortly after Gaddafi had sort of, you know, rolled over and been very compliant.
Yeah, given up his
2003, yeah. Saying, you know, don't come after me. I'm not going to have any weapons of mass destruction as a pretext for the U.S. to attack me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's true.
The effects of those interventions and of those invasions was to convince countries like North Korea that they would need nuclear weapons. But then also, if you look at, you know, what Russia's attack in Ukraine, perhaps this is something that encourages a country like Saudi Arabia or makes them think, hey, I'm vulnerable to aggression if one state, my neighbor, has nuclear weapons and I don't. For Saudi Arabia, if you're looking at a nuclear-armed Iran, perhaps one lesson you draw is that, okay, now if Iran's going to have a nuclear weapons capability, or maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, I need to try to develop that nuclear weapons capability as well. I think this is also making U.S. allies that don't have nuclear weapons, I think, a lot more nervous. So a good example might be South Korea, which sees that, well, you know, again, there's neighbors with North Korea, China, that have nuclear capability. We don't. We're relying on the U.S., but how stable is that relationship? Are they going to come through on their commitment? So I think they're unsure and might want to think of use a nuclear weapons program or a nuclear program as a hedge against that uncertainty.
Again, the term of art from the Cold War was the idea of extending deterrence, or the metaphor of a nuclear umbrella. Mm-hmm. And there were many cases in the European context where we were closely allied and had, you know, significant political and economic interests at play, that there was doubt cast on whether the United States would honor that extended nuclear deterrence if it was really a conflict that might escalate to an exchange between the U.S. and Soviet Union. And I think the expression was, would you really trade New York for Berlin and such? So that led the French to go down this path you're describing. They developed their own nuclear weapons because they could not resolve for themselves that ambiguity and figure that they needed to be ready to fight for France. So in essence, the near future, look out 10 more years, might be, if doubt is cast on this commitment of the United States to defend allies up to the extreme of using nuclear weapons, you might see proliferation to a larger number of countries. So go down the list. You mentioned Saudi Arabia would be one.
Saudi Arabia, South Korea. Japan is a more unique case. I mean, I think if you just took out the history of Japan with their experience, obviously, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, if you took that out and just look at their geopolitical position, it's similar to South Korea's. And so all that to say is there could be pressures there for proliferation. So those are the main countries to worry about with proliferation for the moment, or at least in the near to medium future. All that to say is that, you know, the U.S. has, you know, it's always had to worry about the assurances it gives allies. And there's like this, I forget exactly what his title was, but it's a British guy, Dennis Healy. And he said it takes, you know, maybe like the 100% of, think of 100% of the effort that goes into NATO. And he was using NATO as the example. You know, 10% of it is for deterring the Soviets, but the other 90% is for assuring the allies. And so it underscores how hard it is to assure allies of a U.S. commitment. And if that's not, doesn't seem to be very strong or very stable, then I think it increases the, I think that increases the willingness of these countries to try to go for a nuclear program and get a nuclear weapons capability.
And the third leg of that triad, if you will, not to appropriate a nuclear weapons term there, you talked about deterring the adversary, reassuring allies, but I think I read in looking over some of your work that you've examined public opinion in nuclear weapons in the United
States. Absolutely.
So you've got to reassure the population that you're not overextending yourself and, you know, going to incur nuclear wrath unnecessarily. What's the current, because as I think you started earlier talking about, this is a topic that mostly faded probably from most Americans' perspective at the end of the Cold War, and now it's back. I've seen New York City put together a video on here's how to survive a nuclear blast. It was kind of a CGI augmented reality version, but that had to shake up some people, just like that warning about two years ago when Hawaii got the text alert that said missile inbound.
Missile is incoming and you got to take shelter. People were freaking out.
They were preparing to meet their maker. So what would you say about the American domestic political opinion on nuclear weapons?
So
either what's happened so far or what maybe needs to happen to bring foreign and domestic policy into alignment?
I think, well, there's two things. In terms of what I think I've done research on and what I think actually as a field we've done good research on lately and have a good understanding of now is at least how Americans think about the use of nuclear weapons in general, which is that obviously they're averse to the cost of doing so and would rather not do it. But if there are circumstances in which you can make a case that it is useful and limited and, you know, not going to lead to some big Holocaust, you know, they would support it. And so if maybe there's a case in which, you know, some country struck the United States with nuclear weapons, they would also very much support nuclear use. So in terms of the use of nuclear weapons, I actually think that actually has some good alignment with how, say, the U.S. foreign policy establishment thinks about the use of nuclear weapons, which is that, you know, reserve it for extreme circumstances, for circumstances in which maybe a limited use might be helpful and the only recourse we have, but otherwise try to avoid that. Now, the other thing that I think is less understood is how the risk of nuclear use affects what the public thinks about, you know, the use of force in general. I think it's, you know, when there's always these polls, for instance, on, hey, you know, would you, you know, asking people, would you want to defend Taiwan with force? And it doesn't say anything about the idea that the fact that if we did that, you know, we would be getting into direct conflict with another nuclear armed nation, China.
Which has had general officers before wave the nuclear sword when they were, you know, in the 200 to 300 nuclear weapon arsenal category.
Yeah.
So they were willing to brandish the saber when it was a dagger. And if they're scaling up to 1,000, 1,500, how would you think that affects the debate?
So, that's where I think we're less sure of. I think people themselves are, and like members of the U.S. public themselves are still not quite aware of that nuclear risk whenever they think about should we defend Taiwan or not, or should we, you know, how much should we defend Ukraine or not. I think there's some implicit understanding there, but I don't think it's fully factored in. What I'm kind of finding is that overall, when it comes to, say, Taiwan, which is, I've put out a survey experiment about that, when that's just at baseline, people are ambivalent about using force to defend Taiwan. It's about 50-50. But then it only drops a little bit when you mention the risk of the new use of nuclear weapons.
Interesting.
So I think that overall is that people, you know, I think it's a slight majority of people would prefer not to use force to defend Taiwan. But among the slight minority that does prefer to use force to defend Taiwan, they seem to be very committed to doing so. Or at least maybe they've already factored these risks in. Which is something that would be good to explore, see if in the future, to see if people kind of already think about this, and because of that implicit understanding they have of nuclear risk, maybe they've somehow factored that in into their opinion on whether to defend Taiwan or not.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the demographics and how that aligned by age group. You know, those that grew up and had some memory of the Cold War, and those that have grown up post-Cold War, and it hasn't really been a factor. You know, I guess the test for me would be if you hear people, most communities, even around the Air Force Academy, on like the first Friday of the month, will test their warning sirens. And for some people, when they hear those warning sirens, it's like, oh, that's like the tornado alarm. Because they've grown up in the last 30 years, but matured, particularly, you know, even post September 11th, folks are not going to associate that with those that grew up in the generation exposed to the Cold War, where you have that funny feeling in the back of your neck. Is it the first Friday? Is it 12 o'clock? Or are things going to get really bad in about 10 minutes? Because they associate that with civil defense and nuclear threat as opposed to a weather threat.
Yeah, well, I am of the generation, I was growing up in Oklahoma, and every Saturday at noon, they would test sirens. Yeah. And I always thought of it as the tornado siren, but other people, especially my grandparents, would say, oh, well, it is the tornado siren, for sure, but it's a dual purpose. It can also warn you of an incoming attack. So actually, what in some of the research that I published on this is that we didn't report this finding because we didn't necessarily think it was the biggest finding, but we do see that there was some slight differences and that younger people seem to be more willing to use nuclear weapons than older people. And I think it's because, as you point out, older people more aware of the dangers because they lived through them, because obviously there's not a nuclear attack, but it was presented to them much more than it, I think the dangers of nuclear use are presented to my generation.
Well, it was much more a cultural thing, both cultural and political, because you had the topic of movies in the 80s of various forms. I mean, that was the plot of accidental nuclear war through what we now call artificial intelligence in the War Games movie with Matthew Broderick. I think it was like 82 or 83, something like that.
Yeah.
What else?
The Red Dawn movies.
Red Dawn, yeah. There was a scene actually where China was supposedly fighting on the U.S. side because, you know, Europe sat it out. I'm trying to think. There's a scene with Powers Booth around the fire. Hmm. He's just gotten shot down, and he's telling the kids the story. It's like, well, Europe's setting this one out, except England. They won't last long. And they said half a billion Chinese. And one of the kids, you know, teenagers, says, well, I thought there was a billion Chinese. And he says, there was. Throws his coffee and the fire goes up. And that was the cultural mystique of conveying, this is devastating. Day after. And there were pastoral letters from, like, the Catholic bishops arguing the moral issues associated with deterrence. And there was, I think, a Southern Baptist response, and there was a very lively public debate, which we don't have now, by and large.
No, yeah, I think for finally getting back to a public debate on the role of nuclear weapons in security strategy, and exactly what it is, I think for a while, I mean, I don't think it's as robust as the Cold War, because in the Cold War, you know, I keep when I go through case studies for the book project I'm working on, it's like, all like, oh, here's this prominent person that's just writing about nuclear weapons policy, just like this prominent public intellectual, just like this is deciding to do it, or they'll use commencement speeches as or some public speech somewhere as an excuse, as a platform to make major announcements on nuclear policy. And the idea here being that just the talk about nuclear weapons was much more prevalent in the public sphere.
Well, McNamara, I think, gave the speech at a graduation, as you said, which launched the flexible response doctrine back in the 60s.
That was a declassified version of a speech he had given in Athens a year earlier. So he had given the speech to a classified speech to NATO ministers, like foreign ministers and defense ministers. And, you know, it was a speech that I think had a split reaction among NATO allies, being like, how can you do this? This is, you know, is a conventional defense possible? Are you just trying to wriggle out of your nuclear commitment to us? And I think ultimately, after years of debate, it was settled on no, that's not exactly what we're doing. And yes, a conventional defense of some means is possible. But anyway, it ruffled feathers. He gives a declassified version. It ruffles even more feathers because now it's out in the open that there's this whole debate.
And now you have that 90% of the effort is devoted to reassuring the allies.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
And then, 1979-ish, I think it was, German Chancellor Schmidt gives a speech kind of calling into question the reliability of the U.S. deterrent, and that launches then the Euro missile debate.
Yep.
Torpedoes, more or less, as I recall, his coalition.
Yep.
And then the United States deploys Pershing and ground-launched cruise missiles, and leading to the first actual elimination of an entire
of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. It was, you know, that was something that, oddly enough, Gorbachev and the Soviets were very worried about it. I think they were more worried about Star Wars, so quote unquote, or the Strategic Defense Initiative.
Yeah.
Reagan wanted to try to use space-based systems to create a very robust shield against nuclear weapons with the goal of making nuclear weapons obsolete because you could just destroy them. And, of course, this was, it's still beyond our technology, and it was definitely well beyond the technology in the 1980s and never really got off the ground more than a conceptual stage. But the Soviets were very worried about it.
The concept alone had a very significant impact, it appears, on Soviet thinking.
And so Gorbachev was trying, not only did he want to reduce the number of armaments and put a break on the Cold War arms race, he really wanted to end SDI. You know, Reagan said, stonewalled them, said, no, we're not doing that. But they've reached finally, late 1987, they reached a compromise of, well, we can't really dramatically, we're not going to agree to dramatically reduce our arsenals. We're not going to agree, at least right now, on getting rid of SDI. But what we can do is we can give up these weapons that we regard as dangerous. And ultimately for the U.S., not as useful strategically.
But particularly worrisome for the Soviets because the flight times involved were a lot shorter. And the Soviets didn't matter so much where the missile came from. They worried about where it landed.
Could these be used for counterforce missions? And if so, the Soviets had a launch on warning system for the most part and relied a lot on intercontinental ballistic missiles. And so if these were accurate, fast missiles that could destroy them before they had it, but destroy their ICBMs before they had a chance to respond.
Or forward command posts.
Or maybe blind them. Yeah, knock out command and control. That's a huge problem. So they obviously regard it as a huge problem. And the U.S., it already has lots of nuclear weapons and a robust arsenal. So what exactly is this getting you? It was in, especially as the Cold War was starting to wind down in 1987, a concession that could be made.
Because again, going back to your 90% analogy, they were deployed originally the idea was rationalized to reassure the allies, because those same allies had identified a gap that raised credibility questions. So if by some number of years later, the way to reassure allies was to remove them, accomplishing the same object, basically, just by taking them out. But to bring us up to date and look now where we are in the, this point in history, the INF Treaty has kind of been abrogated by both sides, or both sides are saying we're no longer going to necessarily abide by this. The Russians are fielding things that we say are in violation of that. And I believe within the last couple months, the United States, although we don't have anything in that range in the arsenal now, has speculated that maybe to deter China, we might need to go back to something in that range that's tailored for a deterrent against China if we deploy it across any allied or overseas territories that the United States has access to.
Yeah, so I think I do think that Russia's recent missile capabilities are in violation of the INF. It's been that the accusation has been made. I believe that to be true. And then if that's the case, then it's not necessarily in the U.S. best interest to follow the INF treaty. So it's dangerous that it's now gone. But now that it's gone, the U.S. is taking that advantage of that to then try to say, well, there's these we can develop missile capabilities, say air-launched cruise missiles, that within that range that would give us, that would be oddly enough not as useful against Russia and more useful against China, which was never a signatory of the of the INF treaty.
So what prospect do you think, everything we alluded to, and I'm not going to go into the diplomatic history of nuclear arms control, having sufficiently, I think, introduced the concept of the INF treaty, but those are all bilateral, one-on-one agreements between the United States and the Soviet Union, or the Russians as a successor to the Soviet Union. With the exception of the Non-Proliferation Treaty from the 1960s, there really is no international nuclear weapons agreement, right? That's had all the nuclear powers, sit down to talk about, upper end limits of their particular nuclear capabilities. The Outer Space Treaty has a component about not stationing nuclear weapons of mass destruction in orbit, but that's it. The international diplomatic record is pretty absent anything on nuclear arms control. Do you think there's any chance that that will change, let's say, in the next 10 years? Because you sketched out a little while ago, there's all these states that might start jumping into the nuclear club, right, for a variety of regional reasons. Is there a way to head that off?
Well, I think, it's very difficult. I think when you look at arms control and patterns in arms control, I think not only are most of the deals bilateral, but a lot of the biggest ones, the ones that reduced nuclear weapons by the most, happened when the Soviet Union was essentially retreating. And so, I don't think any of the major powers, great powers, are going to be in retreat. That being said, even in times of great competition, the U.S. and the Soviet Union, along with other nuclear powers, were able to hammer out the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and that treaty is still with us. And there's also, other deals that kind of limit either, say, nuclear testing, such as there was the partial threshold, or there was the partial test ban treaty in 1963 between the United States and the Soviet Union, limiting atmospheric nuclear tests. There was obviously the Anti-Ballistic Missile Defense Treaty in 1972 between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. That's no longer. I point out all this to say that there are certain things, I think, that even in the height of competition, that nuclear powers can agree to. So maybe they can say, maybe there's certain technologies that they agree to limit, like ballistic missile defenses, or perhaps there's certain practices that they want to try to limit, such as other countries' nuclear programs, because it might be in China's interests as well as the United States' interests and Russia's interests to not have all these countries running around with nuclear weapons. And so I think that what you'll see, the problem is that even if there are those mutual interests, there is the level of competition between these countries so high that they just can't cooperate on it, and or don't want to cooperate on it just out of principle. And that's what I think worries me, is that, sure, there might be mutual interest in limiting certain technologies or putting the brakes on proliferation, but the atmosphere is so poisoned that countries don't work together for it.
Yeah, for other reasons, they simply shun, bilateral, multilateral agreements.
Yep.
And therefore nothing happens. And as again, you've sketched out a couple of times already in this conversation, the other countries, mainland China is looking to significantly increase its arsenal over the next, by the end of the decade and into the next. Other countries may jump in, and, if Ukraine passes through this fire and remains independent, it gets its territory back, or even if it doesn't.
Ukraine will definitely
acquire nuclear weapons, which in fairness is, we're coming up on close to 80-year-old technology, right? So the genie is well out of that bottle, and to say that country X or Y doesn't have the technology to develop nuclear weapons, well, a lot of that science has been done. It's access to nuclear material, and probably some of the components are easier to come by these days. So it's really going to take not science being the limiter and technology being the limiter, but, political will.
Even when the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed in the late 1960s, people thought that, recognized that this is not a technology problem anymore.
Yeah.
This is a political problem. And we have to work together to try to limit the spread of this technology. And it has done a remarkably good job doing so, to keep the number of nuclear weapon states in the single digits so far. But if the political cooperation to try to limit the access to that technology erodes, then, it's going to be, all these countries where it's clearly within their means to get nuclear weapons are going to be much, much more able to do so.
Well, I think that's probably a good point to wind the conversation down, is there's a note of hope in there.
Okay.
That possibility might yet be avoided. Otherwise, I think you've given people a good overview to understand the trends that are taking place and how we've come through the Cold War and we're at the place we are now, and this may be an enduring issue. So to wrap up and give you a chance to change gears if you want, I ask you the question I've been concluding the podcast with. In the next 5 years, what change or trend in international domestic politics, economics, law, technology, or culture do you think might have the greatest impact on national security, in your opinion? So in whatever field.
That's a really good question, a big one. I want to say it's something related to cyber realm, and I would just say probably, for lack of a better term, like information overload, in the sense that especially with these large language models, with AI ChatGPT, there is so much information that people are already saturated with, and now they're going to be saturated with even more things that look real, that seem real. It's going to be hard to figure out exactly what to think. And it's, I think, only going to, unfortunately, exacerbate existing echo chambers and polarization, issues with polarization, and U.S. domestic politics. But then if you want to think about how it affects, imagine deep fakes are only becoming more and more effective. Yeah. So imagine the use of a deep fake to sow confusion about exactly what is going on in a particular crisis. That could delay how the U.S. responds to it. It could cause the U.S. to take the wrong response to it and exacerbate the crisis. And so, you know, there's this whole idea, like, so the ability for misinformation now to be generated so easily, I think, is going to have obviously ramifications on our culture, which leads to effects on domestic politics. But there's this idea that's budding now, especially in the field of nuclear politics, of, you know, of, for lack of a better term, like escalation via tweet, or, you know, wormhole escalation, as a scholar named Rebecca Hirschman put it recently, of now there's going to be these unforeseen ways that crises escalate because we're reacting to bad information.
Well, so much for the hopeful note there, but yeah. I think we'll get back. But that's great thinking. And again, the purpose of these conversations is just to get, one, people an opportunity to hear what kind of research is being done at the various schools that are part of the partnership, and you've done a good job of that. And wish you well in your next assignment at the Naval War College.
Yep, Naval War College, starting next month.
That will be very cool. Good luck with that. And again, thanks for taking some time here. And thanks, everyone, for tuning in, so to speak, with this podcast and listening to episode 4. And I hope you've enjoyed hearing about nuclear weapons as a national security topic. And we'll continue this dialogue with other schools in the coming weeks here around Colorado. So stay tuned for those future episodes. In the meantime, if you've got more questions or interested in information about the partnership, just please go to our website, n3sp.org. Thank you and goodbye.